You're listening to the New City Church podcast. These episodes are recorded live on Gadigal land. Sometimes the audio quality might not be perfect because what you're listening to is a conversation. We don't edit out the chatter. We think that's what makes it authentic. Wherever you're tuning in from, we hope you find this episode encouraging.
Good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon, everybody. Let's have a little energy. That was beautiful. It's hard to break that, isn't it? It was kind of like a spell. Welcome once again to New City. My name's Joel. My pronouns are he and him. It's wonderful to be here with you this afternoon. Okay, I'm still coming out of that space. Thank you. That was really precious. I believe they're the songs that are going to be at Beth's wedding. Everyone, Beth's getting married in 2 weeks. Woo! Happy wedding to... No. We're excited for you. We are indeed coming towards the end of Esther. Next week, we're going to do a comparison, a final comparison of Daniel and Esther. We've been reading them intertextually for the nerds amongst us. So here's a question for you. Do we have any fans of Schitt's Creek in the room? Okay, great. Yeah, wonderful. Wonderful. Is there anyone in the room who didn't like Schitt's Creek? Great. We don't have to kick anyone out. Excommunication is not part of New City's history, but it could have been. What about Parks and Recreation? A few folk? 30 Rock? Yes. Do we have any fans of Veep? I'm getting more obscure here. Yeah. Okay. Veep is it's around the vice president in the States, and she is totally incompetent. It's quite hilarious. You should watch it. These are all comedies. Some we would call farces. They are set up to be humorous explorations of humanity, leadership, power, et cetera, et cetera. My contention is that Esther, the book that we're looking at tonight, it's one of the books of the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament. Esther is a comedy. We're supposed to read it and laugh because it's ridiculous. There are characters that make stupid decisions that make absolutely no sense, that are totally illogical, and lo and behold, they end up dead. So I think it's a comedy. I want to put that out there. Do we have any fans of Game of Thrones? Yes. Yeah, that one's a little bit more controversial. Did we ever have anyone who just got bored in Game of Thrones? Yeah, a couple of those. I thought that might happen. There was a scene in Game of Thrones that became quite famous called the Red Wedding. Do people remember that? It was an absolute bloodbath, like a slaughterhouse. Like everyone in the room just got killed. Do we have any fans of Les Miserables? Okay, there we go. We're into something. Maybe we're a musical theater nerd group. Les Miserables, it translates literally to the miserables. I did French at uni. It is a story of hope and love, but ultimately everyone except about two people dies. As the story goes on, kind of they all just die violently and viciously. I think that Esther, the book of Esther, is a violent bloodbath horror tale. I think it is a tale of revenge, and it is dark. So there's my two theories that I'm putting out there. Esther is a comedy, and it's a bloodbath. It's very serious, but also we're supposed to read it and laugh. And I hope this makes sense. But what I want us to see by the end of today, where we'll have all our questions of Esther answered, thank you for laughing, is Esther is a very complicated book of ancient literature, but it's written by a traumatized community who are in exile. The audience, we think the original audience, was a traumatized community who have been ripped out of their homeland, who have had many of their families and friends killed, and they are trying to make sense of really big questions. So I guess the category that we could put it into is dark humor. Do we have any fans of dark humor in the house? Yeah, wonderful. Did anyone not put their hand up then, but actually is deep down a really big fan of deep dark humor? Yeah, okay, thank you. We had to be honest here. It's written as a form of dark humor, and here's the kind of questions that I think Esther wrestles with. And when I say this, I think you'll agree with me that the book of Esther is weirdly relevant to today. Here's the kinds of questions that this dark humor is asking. Where is God in the context of genocide? That's a question that the book of Esther is asking. God is largely absent in Esther, the version that the Protestant Bible has, largely not mentioned, but it is a story of genocide. It asks, when everything in life feels like despair, how do we hold on to hope? When everything in life feels like despair, how do we hold on to hope? The book of Esther, this dark humor, it asks, how can we as a faith community act with integrity when we find ourselves in unjust systems? That's a question that the book of Esther wrestles with. Perhaps relevant to you, the book of Esther asks, who am I when the world asks me to hide who I truly am? I tend to think maybe like three quarters of the room have wrestled with that question. Who am I when I'm not allowed to be who I actually am? When I'm not allowed to be who God has made me to be? What does it mean to belong to a people, to a story, to a God in a world that often feels confusing and foreign? Anyone wrestled with that? By the end of tonight, having concluded the book of Esther, we will have wonderful answers to all of these questions. I'm confident. So here's where we're going. I'm going to retell the story of Esther. We've covered most of it up to this point, so I'll cover those parts really quickly using some artwork. And then we're going to finish the book of Esther tonight, the story. And I need you to engage with me with some participation. Woo, thank you. And as I was writing this, I was like, I know Andy will join in. It's fine. It's fine. And then I looked around and I was like, oh, Andy's here. We're good. Okay, here's what you need to do. Every time that you hear the name Haman, I need you to boo. Okay, or you can hiss. I know you're supposed to boo and hiss, but I actually don't know what sound a hiss is in. It's just like a, so it's not actually a hiss, it's just a s. So it's up to you whether you boo or you hiss. Every time you hear the name Mordecai or Esther, I need you to just give a bit of like cheer, like you, thumbs up, like yeah, go you good thing. Yeah, thank you. It's a bit seedy, but we will go through the book of Esther. And I'll, like up on the screen, there's some artworks. I can't remember what order I put the artworks in, but hopefully they'll make sense. But the story of Esther, thank you, Aiden. Well done. Well done. We're going to forget this very quickly, but we will do it. The story of Esther, it begins in the opulent Persian court of King Xerxes, who rules over a vast empire. The people of Israel, the Jewish nation, have been captured by Persia, as so often happened in the ancient world, and still happens today. A people group have been captured, they've been transferred, they've been dislocated from their land. And that's the setting where we find ourselves. Queen Vashti is the king's wife. Now, she displeases the king. It's a really minor issue. She refuses to rock up before him. He's not a fan, and so he banishes her. She gets kicked out of the area. And so we need a new queen to take the place. Enter Esther. Ah, correct. Good response. Esther becomes queen. Thank you. I've got to remember this myself. She becomes queen when King Xerxes decides to hold a beauty pageant. So if we can go a couple of slides in, what's next? Okay, so this is go back one. This is Xerxes drunk just before he boots Vashti, the queen, out. And the next slide, thousands, but I found about 12. There are a dozen paintings, famous paintings, of Esther being prepared for going before the king. This is essentially a beauty pageant. I like to picture Trump and Miss America. That's kind of the situation that we have here. They're probably quite young girls, quite vulnerable, but the king has decreed, whichever one of these is most beautiful, I am going to marry. Esther has been raised, thank you, by her cousin Mordecai. Yeah, we love Mordecai. Esther and Mordecai are Jewish. There's the complication. Esther keeps her Jewish identity hidden from the king, becomes the queen because Mordecai says, it's probably not safe, so be careful. Meanwhile, Mordecai, he uncovers a plot to kill the king. He discovers this, he reports it to the court, and in return, his name gets put down into the book of royal records. That's important to note. He gets a mention in the book of royal records. It's kind of like everything that happens in the court gets jotted down. And so Mordecai gets a little line. Thank you. Gets a little line in there. Soon after, okay, where are we up to? What's the next photo? This is a good one. Soon after, Haman, correct, a powerful official, damn powerful officials, he is promoted to a high place and he demands public honor. He demands that as he walks through the street, everyone bows to him. So Haman says everyone has to bow to him. Mordecai refuses to bow to Haman. Point blank says, nah, I'm not going to do it. Mordecai gets really pissed. Oh, sorry, no, Haman. Boo, thank you. I was like, that was the wrong noise for this. Okay, Haman gets really pissed off with Mordecai. Thank you. So much so that he decides to kill all the Jews. That is his response. This is the definition of overkill. He goes on this rampage and decides, I'm going to murder all of this people group because of one person's rebellion. And what he does, get this for grotesque, he casts lots. So this is, that is a different character in the Bible, casting lots, but I couldn't find one of Haman casting lots. Thank you very much. So this is Haman casting lots to decide what date should we kill them all? How's that for power? I don't know what casting lots looked like in that time, whether they drew short straws or, literally through dice to work out the dates. But he decided, thanks to the casting of lots, that on the 13th day of the 12th month, all of the Jews in the Persian Empire would be killed. Now, the 13th day of the 12th month, I want you to remember that. It's around February, March, typically in our calendar. The Hebrew calendar follows the lunar cycle, so it doesn't naturally meet up, but the 13th day of the 12th month. In anguish, Mordecai goes to Esther, who is now queen, and says, you need to intercede. The problem is the king has by this point issued a decree that this is what is going to happen. And the king, for some strange rule, can't undo his own decrees. We don't actually think that was historically true, but for the sake of our tragic, dark humor, comedy, farce, horror, he can't undo it. It's also very dangerous for Esther to go before, thank you very much. It's very dangerous for her to go before the king, but after prayer and fasting, Esther resolves to act, declaring, if I perish, I perish. That is bravery, that is courage. And Esther, in both the, thank you, in the Hebrew and Christian traditions, is often upheld for her courage here. She bravely approaches the king, gains his favor, and invites the king and Haman to two banquets, which isn't really what you would expect to happen, but that is what she does, and sets the stage for the great reversal that follows. Meanwhile, furiously mad at Mordecai, Haman sets up a special gallows on which to hang Mordecai. That got dark real quick. Yay, death. Okay. What other pictures do we have? So that is Mordecai speaking to Esther. Our next photo, image. This is another popular trope. This is Esther going before the king. And the words have often been translated, particularly in the King James Version, as she swoons, which in our modern English, it sounds like she's in love with the king. Actually, she is terrified. Like it's more like her heart stops out of fear. That's the type of courage that she has. And the last photo or painting, this is Esther, pointing to Haman for good reason. Thank you. So that is where we got up to in the story of Esther so far. Thank you. You're very good at this. Keep it up. Everyone else, learn a lesson. No, some of you are doing very well. Keep it up. Okay, so we're now up to chapter 6. The king can't sleep. Anyone experienced that before? He is a powerful man, probably with a conscience at this point, and he is tossing and turning. He can't sleep, and so he orders for somebody to come in and read to him his own biography. Naturally, I assume we've all done a similar thing. He asks the court advisors to come in and read out the Royal Chronicles. That is the story of everything that... Now, do you remember what was in the Royal Chronicles? Mordecai. Yes, wonderful. So the king is listening to these Royal Chronicles being read, kind of tossing and turning, putting himself to sleep, and he sits up and he says, oh my goodness, Mordecai saved my life. What did we do to honor Mordecai? Yeah, and the attendants say, well, we did nothing. We just put his name into the book. And he says, okay, well, let's work out something. Haman, the next morning, enters to the king. This is where, you can see where it's a bit of a comedy. His intention is to say, I've built these gallows. I want to get Mordecai executed. That's what Haman goes in to present towards the king. The king, having been up all night, read the chronicles, says to Haman, if I want to honor someone in my kingdom, how should I do it? If I want to honor someone in our kingdom, how should I do it? Somebody who I really delight in, how should I honor them? Now, Haman, arrogant prick that he is, assumes the king is talking about him. Yeah. So he says, well, you would get the most expensive horse, you would get the most expensive robe, you would get the most expensive rings, you would get Cartier watches and Hermes scarves, you would drape them on that person, and you would walk them through the city so that everyone can see them and honor them. And the king turns around and to Haman and says, great, I need you to organize this for Mordecai. Ha ha ha. Haman goes home to his wife, who is very supportive, but it is a sad family dinner. Yeah. So that is our first reversal that takes place in chapter 6. We're now up to chapter 7. Esther hosts another banquet. We've gone through a couple of banquets by now. Hosts another banquet for the king and for Haman. And the king asks her, what is it that she desires? Esther, you, courageously reveals that she is Jewish and accuses Haman, if we go back to that last painting, accuses Haman of plotting her people's destruction. Now, everyone in the room, the three of them, all know that it is a spot-on accusation. The king is enraged, I imagine, for a couple of reasons. First of all, he realizes that he's signed a decree, an irreversible decree, saying that his wife, who he won in the Miss America pageant, is now to be killed. Like, that's one of those moments where you go, oh shit, did I sign that? Did I just kill my wife? Yeah, that, like, that's an awkward realization over dinner. But even worse, just like to add salt to the wound, he realizes that it's Haman who has tricked the advisor, who has tricked him into this. The king leaves the room in a rage. He's got a bit of an anger management issue. He wants to control it, so he steps out. Thumbs up, king. Goes outside, tries to calm himself down. In the meantime, Haman, do we have another painting? You'll have to Google these ones yourself. I think I forgot to put that one in or just got bored. Haman is terrified because he realizes that his fate might be sealed. And so he throws himself at Esther, at her feet, and begs and pleads and says, like, whatever I can do for you, let me do that for you. Let's change the course of action. The king returns and assumes that Haman is actually assaulting the queen. And there's sexual overtones in there. So he assumes that Haman, yeah, good point at this point, has now not only attempted to kill his wife, is now sexually assaulting her. Like, the king is raging. And so he says, great, we already have some gallows set up. And so Haman is hanged on the gallows set up for Mordecai. What a turn. Do we see why it's a bit of a dramedy? There are twists and turns in here that you probably couldn't have seen coming, but we're only up to chapter 7. Esther pleads with the king again and says, I know that you've put out this royal decree that my people are to be killed. I know that you can't reverse that, but please, what can we do? The king does a couple of things at this point. The first one is he takes Mordecai and gives him Haman's job. Oh yeah, boo, but yay. Like, yay, yay for that moment. There is this great reversal that takes place. And that's one of the key things that we need to unpack in Esther. The moments where everything felt like nothing was going to go right, things end up beautifully. Esther and Mordecai plead again for their people's safety. You. The king can't revoke the original decree, but allows a new decree to go out. And that is the Jewish people on, what day was it? The 13th of the 12th month, the Jewish people may defend themselves. It's not that much of a decree, but it's far more than they had. And as the days roll on, the Jewish people organize, they get themselves together, they're prepared, and come the day of death, they actually stand up for themselves. And it doesn't report any Jewish deaths, but it kind of glosses over it to make it sound like there was a red wedding kind of situation where they attempted to be attacked and they overcame. The Jewish people won. I'm really conscious here that I am speaking in a very politically charged environment where something very similar is happening. I am so conscious of that, where we have, again, the Jewish people who have been attacked, threatened, and have responded and retaliated, and everything that has unfolded. I wanna bookmark that for longer conversations, but I also wanna recognize the fact that this is part of the Jewish narrative. Even modern Israel, we'll see within Esther, and we'll get to this, part of this as their identity, that they overcome, that there is time for fighting back, and the disaster that has unfolded in Palestine, and I'm going to use the word genocide here, is atrocious. And that's the context that we're in. It's complicated, it's messy, it's dark. Somehow we have to process what is going on both in Esther and in our world at the moment. I want to suggest that dark humor is a valid way of doing that. It is a valid way of processing it if it's done with respect and dignity. Just to top it off, Haman had 10 sons. Esther requests that those 10 sons are strung up on poles in the middle of the city to teach everybody a lesson. We're no longer in kind of Fawlty Towers territory, are we? This is dark, it's violent, it's bloody. Okay, that is the end of the story, the plot line of Esther, but there's one last chapter, and I'm going to read this part out to you because I think it's really relevant. I'm going to read to you from Esther chapter 9 through to 20. Chapter 9, 20 onward. There's no need to cheer at this point, unless you really want to. Mordecai recorded all of the events that had taken place, and he sent letters to all of the Jews throughout the provinces of King Xerxes, near and far, to have them celebrate annually the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar. Remember, all of this happened on the 13th, and now they're going to have celebrations on the 14th and 15th. When the time came, when the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month, when their sorrow was turned into joy and their mourning into a day of celebration, he wrote them to observe the days as days of feasting and of joy and giving presents of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews, this ancient people group who had survived a genocide, the ancient Jewish people, they agreed to continue the celebration they had begun, doing what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman, still boo, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them. And he had cast Pur. He had cast Pur, P-U-R. Translated, that is lots. He had cast lots, Pur, for their ruin and destruction. But when the plot came to the king's attention, he issued written orders that the evil scheme Haman had devised against the Jews should come back on his own head, and that he and his sons should be impaled on poles. Therefore, these days were called Purim, from the word pur, lots. Because of everything written in this letter and because of what they had seen and what had happened to them, the Jews took it on themselves to establish this custom, that they and their descendants and all who joined them should without fail observe these 2 days every year in the way prescribed and at the time appointed according to the letter that Mordecai sent out. In March this year, Jews all around the world celebrated Purim. It is an annual celebration. And on Purim, that day, the Jewish people in synagogues read out the book of Esther. And as they read out, guess what they do when Haman's name is mentioned? They boo. They boo. And when Mordecai and Esther come onto the scene, they cheer, they celebrate. And this bloodthirsty, violent story is read out as a way of saying, screw you, empire. You tried to kill us, but we're still here. That feels good to say, doesn't it? Perhaps you've experienced that. I'm conscious. And I'm conscious that revenge begets revenge, that cycles of revenge are very true, and I want to name that. I also want to honor the fact that I have never experienced the threat of having my people wiped out. That is not part of my story. I've never faced exile or genocide, so I don't know how I would respond. But I want to recognize the fact that this dark humor is part of a way of coping. It's part of a way of recognizing that even in the darkest moments, hope could still win. And that part I get. Purim, I think, is an incredible celebration because it's named after, literally, a moment when somebody threw some dice and decided on a genocide. And they've taken that name and said, we're going to celebrate the fact that darkness has not won. At the heart of the Jewish faith, and I want to say also woven into the heart of the Christian faith, there is a movement from despair to hope, from certain death to abundant life. So here's the question. In your life, where are you at the moment on the despair to hope continuum? Where would you situate yourself? Thomas and I have some dear, dear friends who we love immensely. And every time for the past, it's been, look, as long as we've been married, every time that I call them or we meet them, inevitably they end up in tears because life has been so hard for them. And our role has just been to sit with them. And witness them as they've gone through mental health challenges, work challenges, fertility challenges. Like at times it has felt utterly insurmountable. Pretty much every time we meet with them, they have said something along the lines of, we're just trying to see where God is in all this, or if God is doing something, we don't know. And at one point they said, I don't really want to see God in all of this. And I think that was a really faithful response as well. But they embodied this form, I think, of Christian hope, of taking a moment of darkness and wanting to see light. And doing it in a way that isn't toxic, that isn't shallow positivity, but saying there is something woven into the thread of reality where goodness can win. If we look at the tradition of scripture, we see that in Exodus. We see it in the wilderness. We see it in Daniel. We see it in the exile. We see it in Babylon and in Persia. We see it in the prodigal son. We see it in the woman at the well. We see it in the cross and resurrection. And the fact that for 2,000 years, a symbol of the Christian tradition has been a Roman form of execution. And we wear around our necks this violent, violent symbol. Because we say, as Christians, we will not let violent empires win. And we won't let violent empires win because we believe that we have a God who fights. I can get behind that. I like that. So in your life, where are you on that despair to hope continuum? If you are in this space and you are well and truly in that seat of despair, where life feels hard, my prayer for you is that the gift of Purim, this festival, this story of Esther, will teach you that despair is real, it's hard, and that even in the darkest times, we face life in the context of community. We gather together and we hiss at Haman, and we say, screw you, empire. And we do that together. And that doesn't say that despair is not real. Like that is the furthest thing. Esther does not think that at all. But it says that we do that together. And we hope, sometimes with laughter, sometimes with anger, that darkness will pass. And perhaps you are on the other side where despair has shaped your story. And that is real. My hope and my prayer for you individually and for us as a community is that despair will become part of our DNA, not in a way that is then harmfully repeated, but in a way that embraces love for one another, reality of hurt, and deeper forms of healing as we pursue Jesus together. So that brings us to the end of the book of Esther. It's dark, isn't it? It's also hilarious. Sounds like life. Can I pray for us? God, we thank you that in our sacred texts, we have preserved for us stories that are just so real and raw. And God, we want to cheer for Esther and then question why on earth she hung 10 sons up in the street. God, we want to hiss at Haman and the power-hungry ways that he sought to kill and slaughter and rob people of their dignity in life. God, we want to rage at the fact that our world is full of Hamans. And we want to turn our eyes to those who are the Mordecais and the Esthers and the Jesuses, who take darkness, who stand with courage, and declare that the empire must not win. God, we long to be a community like that, who does it with wisdom, and God, maybe even laughter on the road. Bless us with that. Amen.